Greetings, listeners. We're back once again to talk to you about the Cthulhu mythos, its books, its monsters, its unfortunate human casualties, its timeline in general, and even its tangential bits like the dreamlands, or things of a weird nature, or things that are Lovecraftian leaning. Weird fiction, science fiction, horror, learn of terrible meetings in lonely places, of cyclopean ruins and vast staircases that lead down to abysses of nighted secrets, of complex angles that lead through invisible walls to other regions of space and time, and of hideous explorations in remote and forbidden places, on other worlds, and in different time-space continua. From the creation of our galaxy to the death of the sun, this is an exploration of the Cthulhu mythos from the perspective of humans' concept of history. We are the people's guide to the Cthulhu mythos. You can find us at pgttcm.com, pgttcm.podbean.com, and you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. The people's guide to the Cthulhu mythos starts now.
The People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos. Season 8.
This episode is brought to you by FoundItemClothing.com and BunnySlippers.com. Subscribe to PGTTCM with DB Spitzer and Seraphie wherever you subscribe to podcasts. We use Podbean and Apple Podcasts personally. Check out our new website over at www.pgttcm.com. Check out the new PGTTCM merch over at pgttcm.threadless.com. Follow on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram as PGTTCM, and YouTube as People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos. Edited by Daniel Spitzer, music by Kevin MacLeod. Help the show out by sharing, rating, and five-star giving wherever you listen and rate podcasts. Support the show by hitting the patron button at pgttcm.com or pgttcm.podbean.com or by going to paypal.me/pgttcm. Again, cool shirts at pgttcm.threadless.com. PGTTCM is part of the Dark Myths Collective. Check them out at darkmyths.org. The Sword of Beleriand and Other Stories is the third book by Irish fantasy writer Lord Dunsany. Considered a major influence on the work of Tolkien, Lovecraft, Le Guin, and others, it was first published in hardcover by George Allen and Sons in October 1908, so about 100 years ago, for anyone who's keeping track, about 110 years ago, for anyone who's keeping track with math skills. And this is read by Ed Humpall, Alex Clark, Lean Tipping, Alex D, and Kevin D, Jaris Amar, Steve Vito, Asef Koss, Roslyn Carlisle, and Sandra. All right, let's get going. Enjoy this Lord Dunsany for this second or third week of October, as we are part of Lord Dunsany's untitled October extravaganza for the month of October, because Daniel didn't come up with a catchy title. Month of October. All right, on with the show.
The Sword of Beleriand and Other Stories by Lord Dunsany. The Highwayman. Tom of the Rhodes had ridden his last ride and was now alone in the night. From where he was, a man might see the white recumbent sheep and the black outline of the lonely downs, and the gray line of the farther and lonelier downs beyond them, or in hollows far below him. Out of the pitiless wind, he might see the gray smoke of hamlets arising from black valleys. But all alike was black to the eyes of Tom, and all the sounds were silence in his ears. Only his soul struggled to slip from the iron chains and to pass southwards into paradise. And the wind blew and blew. For Tom tonight had naught but the wind to ride. They had taken his true black horse on the day when they took him from the green fields and the sky, men's voices and the laughter of women, and had left him alone with chains about his neck to swing in the wind forever. And the wind blew and blew. But the soul of Tom of the Rhodes was nipped by the cruel chains, and whenever it struggled to escape, it was beaten backwards into the iron collar by the wind that blows from paradise from the south. And swinging there by the neck, there fell away old sneers from off his lips, and scoffs that he had long since scoffed at God fell from his tongue, and there rotted old bad lusts out of his heart, and from his fingers the stains of deeds that were evil. And they all fell to the ground and grew there in pallid rings and clusters. And when these ill things had all fallen away, Tom's soul was clean again, as his early love had found it a long while since in spring. And it swung up there in the wind with the bones of Tom, and with his old torn coat and rusty chains. And the wind blew and blew. And ever and anon, the souls of the sepultured, coming from consecrated acres, would go by beating up wind to paradise past the gallows tree and past the soul of Tom that might not go free. Night after night, Tom watched the sheep upon the downs with empty hollow sockets, till his dead hair grew and covered his poor dead face and hid the shame of it from the sheep, and the wind blew and blew. Sometimes on gusts of the wind came someone's tears, and beat against the iron chains, but could not rush them through. And the wind blew and blew. And every evening all the thoughts that Tom had ever uttered came flocking in from doing their work in the world, the work that may not cease, and sat along the gallows branches and chirruped to the soul of Tom, the soul that might not go free. All the thoughts that he had ever uttered, and the evil thoughts rebuked the soul that bore them because they might not die, and all those that he had uttered the most furtively chirruped the loudest and the shrillest in the branches all the night. And all the thoughts that Tom had ever thought about himself now pointed at the wet bones and mocked at the old torn coat, but the thoughts that he had had of others were the only companions that his soul had to soothe it in the night as it swung to and fro. And they twittered to the soul and cheered to the poor dumb thing that could have dreams no more, till there came a murderous thought and drove them all away. And the wind blew and blew. Paul, Archbishop of Alois and Vayence, lay in his white sepulchre of marble facing full to the southwards towards paradise, and over his tomb was sculptured the cross of Christ, that his soul might have repose. No wind howled here as it howled in the lonely treetops up upon the downs, but came with gentle breezes, orchard-scented, over the lowlands from paradise from the southwards, and played about forget-me-nots and grasses in the consecrated land, where lay the reposeful round the sepulchre of Paul, Archbishop of Alois and Vayence. Easy it was for a man's soul to pass from such a sepulchre, and flitting low over remembered fields, to come upon the garden lands of paradise, and find eternal ease. And the wind blew and blew. In a tavern of foul repute, three men were lapping gin. Their names were Joe and Will and the gypsy Puglioni. None other names had they, for of whom their fathers were they had no knowledge, but only dark suspicions. Sin had caressed and stroked their faces often with its paws, but the face of Puglioni Sin had kissed all over the mouth and chin. Their food was robbery and their pastime murder. All of them had incurred the sorrow of God and the enmity of man. They sat at a table with a pack of cards before them, all greasy with the marks of cheating thumbs, and they whispered to one another over their gin, but so low that the landlord of the tavern and the other end of the room could hear only muffled oaths, and knew not by whom they swore or what they said.
We'd like to thank you for listening to People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos. Our sponsor is BunnySlippers.com, your finest source of wonderful Cthulhu slippers, and cool, cool shirts from FoundItemClothing.com, your favorite shirts from your favorite cult films, and also these fine folks.
These three were the staunchest friends that ever God had given unto a man, and he to whom their friendship had been given had nothing else besides, saving some bones that swung in the wind and rain, and an old torn coat and iron chains, and a soul that might not go free. But as the night wore on, the three friends left their gin and stole away, and crept down to that graveyard where rested in his sepulchre Paul, Archbishop of Alois and Vayence. At the edge of the graveyard, but outside the consecrated ground, they dug a hasty grave, two digging while one watched in the wind and rain. And the worms that crept in the unhallowed ground wondered and waited. And the terrible hour of midnight came upon them with its fears and found them still beside the place of tombs. And the three friends trembled at the horror of such an hour in such a place, and shivered in the wind and drenching rain, but still worked on. And the wind blew and blew. Soon they had finished, and at once they left the hungry grave with all its worms unfed, and went away over the wet fields, stealthily but in haste, leaving the place of tombs behind them in the midnight. And as they went they shivered, and each man as he shivered cursed the rain aloud. And so they came to the spot where they had hidden a ladder and a lantern. There they held long debate whether they should light the lantern, or whether they should go without it for fear of the king's men. But in the end it seemed to them better that they should have the light of their lantern, and risk being taken by the king's men and hanged, than that they should come suddenly face to face in the darkness, with whatever one might come face to face with a little after midnight about the gallows tree. On three roads in England, whereon it was not the wont of folk to go their ways in safety, travellers tonight went unmolested. But the three friends, walking several paces wide of the king's highway, approached the gallows tree, and Will carried the lantern, and Joe the ladder. But Puglioni carried a great sword wherewith to do the work which must be done. When they came close, they saw how bad was the case with Tom, for little remained of that fine figure of a man and nothing at all of his great resolute spirit. Only as they came, they thought they heard a whimpering cry like the sound of a thing that was caged and unfree. To and fro in the winds swung the bones and the soul of Tom, for the sins that he had sinned on the king's highway against the laws of the king. And with shadows and a lantern through the darkness, at the peril of their lives, came the three friends that his soul had won before it swung in chains. Thus the seeds of Tom's own soul that he had sown all his life had grown into a gallows tree that bore in season iron chains in clusters, while the careless seeds that he had strewn here and there, a kindly jest and a few merry words, had grown into the triple friendship that would not desert his bones. Then the three set the ladder against the tree, and Puglioni went up with his sword in his right hand, and at the top of it he reached up and began to hack at the neck below the iron collar. Presently the bones and the old coat and the soul of Tom fell down with a rattle, and a moment afterwards his head that had watched so long alone swung clear from the swinging chain. These things Will and Joe gathered up, and Puglioni came running down his ladder, and they heaped upon its rungs the terrible remains of their friend, and hastened away wet through the rain, with the fear of phantoms in their hearts and horror lying before them on the ladder. By 2 o'clock they were down again in the valley out of the bitter wind, but they went on past the open grave into the graveyard all among the tombs, with their lantern and their ladder and the terrible thing upon it, which kept their friendship still. Then these three that had robbed the law of its due and proper victim still sinned on for what was still their friend, and levered out the marble slabs from the sacred sepulchre of Paul, the Archbishop of Alois and Vayence, and from it they took the very bones of the Archbishop himself, and carried them away to the eager grave that they had left, and put them in and shoveled back the earth. But all that lay on the ladder they placed with a few tears within the great white sepulchre under the cross of Christ, and put back the marble slabs. Thence the soul of Tom, arising hallowed out of sacred ground, went at dawn down the valley, and, lingering a little about his mother's cottage and old haunts of childhood, passed on and came to the wide lands beyond the clustered homesteads. There met with it all the kindly thoughts that the soul of Tom had ever had, and they flew and sang beside it all the way southwards, until at last, with singing all about it, it came to paradise. But Will and Joe and the gypsy Puglioni went back to their gin, and robbed and cheated again in the tavern of foul repute, and knew not that in their sinful lives they had sinned one sin at which the angels smiled.
The Sword of Welleran and Other Stories by Lord Dunsany. In the twilight. The lock was quite crowded with boats when we capsized. I went down backwards for some few feet before I started to swim. Then I came spluttering upwards towards the light. But instead of reaching the surface, I hit my head against the keel of a boat and went down again. I struck out almost at once and came up. But before I reached the surface, my head crashed against the boat for the second time, and I went right to the bottom. I was confused and thoroughly frightened. I was desperately in need of air, and knew that if I hit a boat for the third time, I should never see the surface again. Drowning is a horrible death, notwithstanding all that has been said to the contrary. My past life never occurred to my mind, but I thought of many trivial things that I might not do or see again if I were drowned. I swam up in a slanting direction, hoping to avoid the boat that I had struck. Suddenly, I saw all the boats in the lock quite clearly just above me, and every one of their curved varnished planks and the scratches and chips upon their keels. I saw several gaps among the boats where I might have swam up to the surface, but it did not seem worthwhile to try and get there, and I had forgotten why I wanted to. Then all the people leaned over the sides of their boats. I saw the light flannel suits of the men and the colored flowers of the women's hats, and I noticed details of their dresses quite distinctly. Everybody in the boats was looking down at me. Then they all said to one another, "We must leave him now." And they and the boats went away, and there was nothing above me but the river and the sky, and on either side of me were the green weeds that grew in the mud, for I had somehow sunk back to the bottom again. The river as it flowed by murmured not unpleasantly in my ears, and the rushes seemed to be whispering quite softly among themselves. Presently, the murmuring of the river took the form of words, and I heard it say, "We must go on to the sea. We must leave him now." Then the river went away, and both its banks, and the rushes whispered, "Yes, we must leave him now." And they too departed, and I was left in a great emptiness staring up at the blue sky. Then the great sky bent over me, and spoke quite softly like a kindly nurse soothing some little foolish child. And the sky said, "Goodbye. All will be well. Goodbye." And I was sorry to lose the blue sky, but the sky went away. Then I was alone, with nothing round about me. I could see no light, but it was not dark. There was just absolutely nothing, above me and below me and on every side. I thought that perhaps I was dead, and that this might be eternity, when suddenly some great southern hills rose up all round about me, and I was lying on the warm grassy slope in a valley in England. It was a valley that I had known well when I was young, but I had not seen it now for many years. Beside me stood the tall flower of the mint. I saw the sweet-smelling thyme flower, and one or two wild strawberries. there came up to me from fields below me the beautiful smell of hay, and there was a break in the voice of the cuckoo. There was a feeling of summer and of evening and of lateness and of Sabbath in the air. The sky was calm and full of a strange color, and the sun was low. The bells in the church in the village were all a-ring, and the chimes went wandering with echoes up the valley towards the sun. And whenever the echoes died, a new chime was born. And all the people of the village walked up a stone-paved path under a black oak porch and went into the church. And the chime stopped, and the people of the village began to sing. And the level sunlight shone on the white tombstones that stood all around the church. Then there was a stillness in the village, and shouts and laughter came up from the valley no more. Only the occasional sound of the organ and of song. And the blue butterflies, those that love the chalk, came and perched themselves on the tall grasses, five or six sometimes on a single piece of grass. And they closed their wings and slept, and the grass bent a little beneath them. And from the woods along the tops of the hills, the rabbits came hopping out and nibbled the grass, and hopped a little further and nibbled again. And the large daisies closed their petals up, and the birds began to sing. Then the hills spoke, all the great chalk hills that I loved. And with a deep and solemn voice they said, "We have come to you to say goodbye." And there was nothing again all round about me upon every side. I looked everywhere for something on which to rest the eye. Nothing. Suddenly, a low gray sky swept over me, and a moist air met my face. A great plane rushed up to me from the edge of the clouds. On two sides it touched the sky, and on two sides between it and the clouds, a line of low hills lay. One line of hills booted gray in the distance. The other stood the patchwork of little square green fields, with a few white cottages about it. The plain was an archipelago of a million islands, each about a yard square or less, and every one of them was red with heather. I was back on the bog of Allen again after many years, and it was just the same as ever, though I had heard that they were draining it. I was with an old friend whom I was glad to see again, for they had told me that he died some years ago. He seemed strangely young, but what surprised me most was that he stood upon a piece of bright green moss, which I had always learned to think would never bear. I was glad, too, to see the old bog again, and all the lovely things that grew there, the scarlet mosses and the green mosses and the firm and friendly heather, and the deep silent water. I saw a little stream that wandered vaguely through the bog, and little white shells down in the clear depths of it. I saw, a little way off, one of the great pools where no islands are, with rushes round its borders, where the duck loved to come. I looked long at the untroubled world of heather, and then I looked at the white cottages on the hill, and saw the gray smoke curling from their chimneys, and knew that they had burned turf there, and longed for the smell of burning turf again. And far away, there arose and came nearer a weird cry of wild and happy voices, and a flock of geese appeared that was coming from the northward. Then their cries blended into one great voice of exultation, the voice of freedom, the voice of Ireland, the voice of the waste. And the voice said, "Goodbye to you, goodbye," and passed away into the distance. And as it passed, the tame geese on the farms cried out to their brothers up above them that they were free. Then the hills went away, and the bog and the sky went with them, and I was alone again, as lost souls are alone. Then there grew up beside me the red brick buildings of my first school and the chapel that adjoined it. The fields a little way off were full of boys in white flannels playing cricket. On the asphalt playing ground, just by the schoolroom windows, stood Agamemnon, Achilles, and Odysseus, with their Argives army behind them, but Hector stepped down out of a ground floor window, and in the schoolroom were all Priam's sons and the Archians and fair Helen, and a little farther away the 10,000 drifted across the playground, going up into the heart of Persia to place Cyrus on his brother's throne. And the boys that I knew called to me from the fields and said, "Goodbye." And they and the fields went away. And the 10,000 said, "Goodbye," each file as they passed me marching swiftly. And they too disappeared. And Hector and Agamemnon said goodbye. And the host of the Argives and of the Archians. And they all went away, and the old school with them. And I was alone again. The next scene that filled the emptiness was rather dim. I was being led by my nurse along a little footpath over a common in Surrey. She was quite young. Close by, a band of gypsies had lit their fire. Near them, their romantic caravan stood unhorsed, and the horse cropped grass beside it. It was evening, and the gypsies muttered round their fire in a tongue unknown and strange. Then they all said in English, "Goodbye." And the evening and the common and the campfire went away. And instead of this, a white highway with darkness and stars below it that led into darkness and stars, but at the near end of the road were common fields and gardens. And there I stood, close to a large number of people, men and women. And I saw a man walking alone down the road away from me, towards the darkness and the stars. And all the people called him by his name, and the man would not hear them, but walked on down the road, and the people went on calling him by his name. But I became irritated with the man, because he would not stop or turn around when so many people called him by his name, and it was a very strange name. And I became wary of hearing the strange name so often repeated, so that I made a great effort to call him, that he might listen, and that the people might stop repeating this strange name. And with the effort, I opened my eyes wide, and the name that the people called was my own name. And I lay on the river's bank, with men and women bending over me, and my hair was wet.
The Sword of Welleran and Other Stories by Lord Dunsany. The Ghosts. The argument that I had with my brother in his great lonely house will scarcely interest my readers. Not those, at least, whom I hope may be attracted by the experiment that I undertook, and by the strange things that befell me in that hazardous region into which so lightly and so ignorantly I allowed my fancy to enter. It was at Onalay that I had visited him. Now Onalay stands in a wide isolation, in the midst of a dark gathering of old whispering cedars. They nod their heads together when the north wind comes, and nod again and agree, and furtively grow still again, and say no more a while. The north wind is to them like a nice problem among wise old men. They nod their heads over it, and mutter about it altogether. They know much, those cedars. They have been there so long. Their grandsires knew Lebanon, and the grandsires of these were the servants of the king of Tyre, and came to Solomon's court. And amidst these black-haired children of gray-headed time stood the old house of Onalay. I know not how many centuries had lashed against it their evanescent foam of years, but it was still unshattered, and all about it were the things of long ago, as cling strange growths to some sea-defying rock. Here, like the shells of long-dead limpets, was armor that men encased themselves in long ago. Here, too, were tapestries of many colors, beautiful as seaweed. No modern flotsam ever drifted hither, no early Victorian furniture, no electric light. The great trade routes that littered the years with empty meat tins and cheap novels were far from here. Well, well, the centuries will shatter it and drive its fragments onto distant shores. Meanwhile, while it yet stood, I went on a visit there to my brother, and we argued about ghosts. My brother's intelligence on this subject seemed to me to be in need of correction. He mistook things imagined for things having an actual existence. He argued that secondhand evidence of persons having seen ghosts proved ghosts to exist. I said that even if they had seen ghosts, this was no proof at all. Nobody believes that there are red rats, though there is plenty of first-hand evidence of men having seen them in delirium. Finally, I said I would see ghosts myself and continue to argue against their actual existence. So I collected a handful of cigars and drank several cups of very strong tea, and went without my dinner and retired into a room where there was a dark oak and all the chairs were covered with tapestry. And my brother went to bed bored with our argument and trying hard to dissuade me from making myself uncomfortable. All the way up the old stairs as I stood at the bottom of them, and as his candle went winding up and up, I heard him still trying to persuade me to have supper and go to bed. It was a windy winter, and outside the cedars were muttering I know not what about, but I think that they were Tories of a school long dead, and were troubled about something new. Within, a great damp log upon the fireplace began to squeak and sing, and struck up a whining tune, and a tall flame stood up over it and beat time, and all the shadows crowded round and round and began to dance. In distant corners, old masses of darkness sat like chaperones and never moved. Over there, in the darkest part of the room, stood a door that was always locked. It led into the hall, but no one ever used it. Near that door, something had happened once, of which the family are not proud. We do not speak of it. There in the firelight stood the venerable forms of the old chairs. The hands that have made their tapestries lay far beneath the soil. The needles with which they wrought were many separate flakes of rust. No one wove now in that old room. No one but the assiduous ancient spiders who, watching by the deathbed of things of yore, worked shrouds to hold their dust. In shrouds about the cornices already lay the heart of the oak wainscot that the worm had eaten out. Surely at such an hour, in such a room, a fancy already excited by hunger and strong tea might see the ghosts of former occupants. I expected nothing less. The fire flickered and the shadows danced. Memories of strange historic things rose vividly in my mind. But midnight chimed solemnly from a 7-foot clock, and nothing happened. My imagination would not be hurried, and the chill that is with the small hours had come upon me, and I had nearly abandoned myself to sleep, when in the hall adjoining there arose a rustling of silk dresses that I had waited for and expected. Then there entered two by two the high-born ladies and their gallants of Jacobean times. They were little more than shadows, very dignified shadows, and almost indistinct. But you have read all the ghost stories before. You have all seen in museums the dresses of those times. There is little need to describe them. They entered, several of them, and sat down on the old chairs, perhaps a little carelessly considering the value of the tapestries. Then the rustling of their dresses ceased. Well, I had seen ghosts, and was neither frightened nor convinced that ghosts existed. I was about to get up out of my chair and go to bed, when there came a sound of pattering in the hall, a sound of bare feet coming over the polished floor. And every now and then a foot would slip and I heard claws scratching along the wood as some four-footed thing lost and regained its balance. I was not frightened, but uneasy. The pattering came straight towards the room that I was in. Then I heard the sniffing of expectant nostrils. Perhaps uneasy was not the most suitable word to describe my feelings then. Suddenly, a herd of black creatures larger than bloodhounds came galloping in. They had large, pendulous ears. Their noses were to the ground, sniffing. They went up to the lords and ladies of long ago and fawned about them disgustingly. Their eyes were horribly bright and ran down to great depths. When I looked into them, I knew suddenly what these creatures were, and I was afraid. They were the sins, the filthy, immoral sins of these courtly men and women. How demure she was, the lady that sat near me on an old-world chair. How demure she was, and how fair. To have beside her with its jowl upon her lap a sin with such cavernous red eyes. A clear case of murder. And you, yonder lady, with the golden hair, surely not you. And yet that fearful beast with the yellow eyes slinks from you to yonder courtier there, and whenever one drives it away, it slinks back to the other. Over there, a lady tries to smile as she strokes the loathsome furry head of another sin. but one of her own is jealous and intrudes itself under her hand. Here sits an old nobleman with his grandson on his knee, and one of the great black sins of the grandfather is licking the child's face and has made the child its own. Sometimes a ghost would move and seek another chair, but always his pack of sins would move behind him. Poor ghosts. Poor ghosts. How many flights they must have attempted for 200 years from their hated sins. How many excuses they must have given for their presence, and the sins were with them still, and still unexplained. Suddenly, one of them seemed to scent my living blood, and bayed horribly, and all the others left their ghosts at once and dashed up to the sin that had given tongue. The brute had picked up my scent near the door by which I had entered, and they moved slowly nearer to me, sniffing along the floor, and uttering every now and then their fearful cry. I saw the whole thing had gone too far. But now they had seen me. Now they were all about me. They sprang up trying to reach my throat, and whenever their claws touched me, horrible thoughts came into my mind, and unutterable desires dominated my heart. I planned bestial things as these creatures leaped around me, and planned them with a masterly cunning. A great red-eyed murder was among the foremost of those furry things, from whom I feebly strove to defend my throat. Suddenly, it seemed to me good that I should kill my brother. It seemed important to me that I should not risk being punished. I knew where a revolver was kept. After I shot him, I would dress the body up and put flour on the face like a man that had been acting as a ghost. It would be very simple. I would say that he had frightened me, and the servants had heard us talking about ghosts. There were one or two trivialities that would have to be arranged, but nothing escaped my mind. Yes. It seemed very good to me that I should kill my brother as I looked into the red depths of the creature's eyes. But one last effort as they dragged me down. If two straight lines cut one another, I said, the opposite angles are equal. Let AB, CD cut one another at E. Then the angles CEA, CEB equal two right angles. Prop 8. Also, CEA, AED equal two right angles. I moved towards the door to get the revolver. A hideous exultation arose among the beasts. But the angle CEA is common, therefore AED equals CEB. In the same way, CEA equals DEB, QED. It was proved. Logic and reason reestablished themselves in my mind. There were no dark hounds of sin. The tapestried chairs were empty. It seemed to me an inconceivable thought that a man should murder his brother.
The Sword of Welleran and Other Stories by Lord Unsany. The Whirlpool. Once going down to the shore of the great sea, I came upon the Whirlpool, lying prone upon the sand, and stretching his huge limbs in the sun. I said to him, "Who art thou?" And he said,
"I am named Nuzwana, the Whelmer of Ships, and from the Straits of Pondar Obed I am come, wherein it is my wont to vex the seas. There I chased Leviathan with my hands when he was young and strong. Often he slipped through my fingers and away into the weed forests that grow below the storms, in the dusk, on the floor of the sea. But at last I caught and tamed him, for there I lurk upon the ocean's floor, midway between the knees of either cliff, to guard the passage of the straits from all the ships that seek the further seas. And whenever the white sails of the tall ships come swelling round the corner of the crag, out of the sunlit spaces of the known sea, and into the dark of the straits, then standing firm upon the ocean's floor, with my knees a little bent, I take the waters of the straits in both my hands, and whirl them round my head. But the ship comes gliding on with the sound of the sailors singing on her decks, all singing songs of the islands, and carrying the rumor of their cities to the lonely seas, till they see me suddenly astride, athwart their course, and are caught in the waters as I whirl them round my head. Then I draw in the waters of the straits towards me and downwards, nearer and nearer to my terrible feet, and hear in my ears, above the roar of my waters, the ultimate cry of the ship. For just before I drag them to the floor of ocean, and stamp them asunder with my wrecking feet, ships utter their ultimate cry, and with it go the lives of all the sailors and passes the soul of the ship. And in the ultimate cry of ships are the songs the sailors sing, and their hopes and all their loves, and the song of the wind among the masts and timbers when they stood in the forest long ago, and the whisper of the rain that made them grow, and the soul of the tall pine tree or the oak. All this a ship gives up in one cry, which she makes at the last, and at that moment I would pity the tall ship if I might. But a man may feel pity who sits in comfort by his fireside, telling tales in the winter. No pity are they permitted ever to feel, who do the work of the gods. And so, when I have brought her circling from round my shoulders to my waist, and thence, with her masts all sloping inwards, to my knees, and lower still and downward still, her topmast pennons flutter against my ankles. Then I, Nuzwana, whelmer of ships, lift up my feet and trample her beams asunder, and there go up again to the surface of the straits, only a few broken timbers and the memories of the sailors and of their early loves to drift forever down the empty seas. Once in every 100 years, for one day only, I go to rest myself along the shore and to sun my limbs on the sand, that the tall ships may go through the unguarded straits and find the happy isles. And the happy isles stand midmost among the smiles of the sunny further seas. And there the sailors may come upon content and long for nothing. Or if they long for aught, they shall possess it. There comes not time with his devouring hours, nor any of the evils of the gods or man. These are the islands whereto the souls of the sailors every night put in from all the world to rest from going up and down the seas, to behold again the vision of far-off intimate hills that lift their orchards high above the fields facing the sunlight, and for a while again to speak with the souls of old. But about the dawn dreams twitter and arise, and circling thrice around the happy isles, set out again to find the world of men, then follow the souls of the sailors, as, at evening, with slow stroke of stately wings, the heron follows behind the flight of multitudinous rooks. But the souls returning find awakening bodies, and endure the toil of the day. Such are the happy isles, whereunto few have come, save but as roaming shadows in the night, and for only a little while. But longer than is needed to make me strong and fierce again, I may not stay. And at set of sun, when my arms are strong again, and when I feel in my legs that I can plant them fair and bent upon the floor of ocean, then I go back to take a new grip upon the waters of the straits, and to guard the further seas again for 100 years, because the gods are jealous lest too many men shall pass to the happy isles and find content, for the gods have not content.
The Sword of Welleran and Other Stories by Lord Dunsany. The Hurricane. One night I sat alone on the great down, looking over the edge of it at a murky, sullen city. All day long, with its smoke, it had troubled the holy sky, and now it sat there, roaring in the distance, and glared at me with its furnaces and lighted factory windows. Suddenly I became aware that I was not the only enemy of that city, for I perceived the colossal form of the hurricane, walking over the down towards me, playing idly with the flowers as he passed, and near me he stopped and spake to the earthquake, who had come up, mole-like but vast, out of a cleft in the earth. "Old friend," said the hurricane, "rememberest when we wrecked the nations and drave the herds of the sea into new pasturage?" "Yes," said the earthquake drowsily. "Yes, yes." "Old friend," said the hurricane, "there are cities everywhere. Over thy head, while thou didst sleep, they have built them constantly. My 4 children, the winds, suffocate with the fumes of them. The valleys are desolate of flowers, and the lovely forests are cut down since last we went abroad together." The earthquake lay there with his snout towards the city, blinking at the lights, while the tall hurricane stood beside him, pointing fiercely at it. "Come," said the hurricane, "let us fare forth again and destroy them, that all the lovely forests may come back, and the furry creeping things. Thou shalt whelm these cities utterly, and drive the people forth, and I will smite them in the shelterless places, and sweep their desecrations from the sea. Wilt thou come forth with me and do this thing for the glory of it? Wilt thou wreck the world again as we did, thou and I, or ever man had come? Wilt thou come forth to this place at this hour tomorrow night?" "Yes," said the earthquake, "yes." And he crept to his cleft again, and head foremost waddled down into the abysses. When the hurricane strode away, I got up quietly and departed, but at that hour of the next night I came up cautiously to the same spot. There I found the huge grey form of the hurricane alone, with his head bowed in his hands, weeping, for the earthquake sleeps long and heavily in the abysses, and he would not wake. End of section 9.
Thank you again for joining us for The Sword of Welleran and Other Stories by Lord Dunsany. This is October, so expect this for more of October. And hope you really enjoy the stories. And we'll figure out what we're going to do for November, but Lord Dunsany right now. Thanks again to BunnySlippers.com, FoundItemClothing.com, and DarkMyths.org. Alright, have a good day. And remember, keep it weird and stay squiggly.